Dalton's Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch. If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask Kiefer Sutherland's father what he thinks.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
This episode, Milton's guest is Martin Lorbecki. Martin is a comic book artist based in the United Kingdom. Martin's work has a distinctive style and is featured in the upcoming anthology series Uncanny Valley, which is now on Kickstarter.
Martin, thanks for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Hi, Milton.
I'm so glad to be talking with you. This is a long-awaited date for both of us because you have been putting together the pitch for a Kickstarter for a very, very long time. And this week, you are finally launching the campaign. And so I was wondering, we will go into much more detail in a moment, but tell us a little bit about the campaign, which by the time they hear this, will have launched.
Okay. The Kickstarter that's going to be launched hopefully on 3rd of May, this Monday, is the first collection of an anthology project that I've been working on with a comic book writer, Rick Quinn, since 2018, the first anthology of Uncanny Valley Archive 001. And it's a collection of sci-fi short stories based on like anthologies like Black Mirror. I think Rick was inspired by Twilight Zone, and for me, I think my inspirations was like Kashiro Otomo's Memories and the indie comic writer Lando's Garden of Glass, and recently the Netflix animated anthology Love, Death, and Robots.
Fantastic. Now, Memories, is that a manga?
It's a manga originally to start off with, but then it became a collection of three short films in the, I think, at the late 90s. So one of the short films was actually based on a short story that Kashiro Otomo wrote and drew himself, but then the other two are kind of loosely based on just like other creators' own ideas.
Okay. I will definitely have to check that out. I have never consumed any of that in any format. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, so
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that Kesho Otomo's anthology stories are really interesting, worth reading.
That's great. And I'm happy that the listeners to the podcast here will already learn one of your strengths as a creator. I've befriended you for a number of years now, so I've been privy to the fact that you are quite a consistent source of fascinating influences and constantly recommending good comics, manga, anime, games, music that I've never heard of. So everyone should follow your social media just to get your recommendations.
Yeah, I do weekly recommendations from my archives every Thursdays, I try. So yeah, it's worth checking them out.
Yeah, you do a really good job of choosing things that like-minded people would really be interested in, but may not have, ever heard of.
Yeah, I try to recommend stuff that maybe not people have heard about frequently, but also trying to make sure that you can still get access to it, because I think one recommendation I made was a few weeks ago. I thought I looked back on it and I realized, oh, this book I recommend is cost like hundreds of dollars and pounds to get a used copy for it. So it's like sometimes I have difficulties trying to figure out a good recommendation every week now.
Yeah. You do. I highly recommend your social media feed to everyone for that. And we will say what that is at the end of the program. Let's keep everybody, on their toes waiting to hear that. So let's back up before we go into detail of the Uncanny Valley anthology. I'd be curious to learn more about your journey into becoming a comics creator. First, let's start. Where did you begin your journey in terms of reading comics?
I think reading comics because I think for me, because at a very young age, I was diagnosed with the autistic spectrum disorder. So one of the things with my autism was I had a lot of difficulties reading like novels, like almost like heavily worded books. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't like concentrate and focus. And I think I was found it much more easier to read comics. I think like one that I can remember from earliest memories, the Tintin comics, like getting them from the libraries and then getting the odd copies for like birthdays and Christmas and just reading those. And then I think during teenage years, I've learned the existence of a comic book shop in my local hometown, and then just gradually just started getting more into comics. I think one of my first big comic book series that I really got into was actually BPRD, not Hellboy itself.
So, oh, wow. Okay.
So I actually got really more interested in BPRD, and I think when I learned about this comic book shop and realizing the existence of subscriptions for it, I ended up buying and reading from like my late teens to my current into recent years, everything from BPRD's, I think, the Hell on Earth story arc, which was probably been one of my favorite long-running comic book series I've read of all time.
That's fantastic.
So, but then, yeah, so just I got into comics and just got really interested. And I think during like after school and doing college and then just kind of, I think I was doing like graphic design studies in college and still kind of getting interested in comics during then. So I just kind of made the odd comic when I can. And then when I went to university to study illustration, I'd just kind of continue working on it. And then I think end of year made my first like proper like 16 page short comic. But then I think after that was around 2014 when I made that first comic, I almost had about 2 or 3 years of not making comics.
And why was that?
I think it was just because when I graduated, I realized I needed to get a day job to essentially pay for things. And so I just didn't really have, I think, busy with a day job. And I just didn't think I didn't have the motivation or the motivation. Yeah, the motivation to make a comic. So I just kind of did my J job. But during all of that, I think it was on Tumblr. I just did constantly posted sketches and concept drawings of ideas of like sci-fi post-apocalyptic worlds I was thinking of at the time. And then I think it was 2017. After starting a different job, and I think I encountered a Tumblr post which was promoting actually one of Rick's comics, which was Saltwater. So I liked that and shared it and all of that. And then all of a sudden I got a message from the guy, from Rick himself, saying, "Hey, thank you for sharing. I also had a look at your work, and would you be interested in doing a comic with me?" So my returning into making comics, which was
That's amazing. So, are you pretty sure that interaction took place on Tumblr?
Yeah, it started on Tumblr initially, and then I think when Tumblr got a bit weird, I shifted over to Twitter, so it all kind of went on there, and Instagram, and just kept in touch with Rick. And then I think after we did made and release Ghost Butterfly, he came back to me with another proposal, which was the Uncanny Valley anthology, which then did Earworm. And then I did some other comics with, I think, Edward Haynes for one called Drift. And then a guy who found my work through, oh, actually, I just completely forgot about that. I did actually do a 2-page anthology for a zine, so he found some of my work that way. So I did a 16-page short comic with him that was called Ellie, which was a pilot pitch sci-fi comic, which was fun to do as well. And then And then throughout those years as well, I've just been working with Rick to doing comics for Uncanny Valley.
So the fact that you and Rick met on Tumblr, I think, is going to be an important piece of internet history that we should note. That will justify the existence of that crazy platform in and of itself.
Yeah.
So that's good to know.
But
so,
sadly,
go ahead. But yeah, it went weird, and I don't even know if it still exists.
It still exists, but I destroyed my Tumblr blog, so all of my previous work from I think from 2013 to I think it's 17 or 18 is all gone now. But it's still, I think all the original drawings I did for those years are sitting on a hard drive somewhere.
I remember distinctly about like a year before all of their content controversies, they had a redesign. And yeah. I know there's often a knee-jerk response to redesigns that are in the negative, but I think this is objectively true that they ruined their own site with their redesign, because one of the things that I loved about Tumblr was you could hit a hashtag for a sub-community and bring up just this wall of content that you could glance at immediately. Mm-hmm. And like if there was a certain TV show you liked or something, you know, you could check in like 8 hours after the episode aired and you'd see all the memes and you could guess like, okay, the community dug it, the community's divided on it. It was a cool resource for that. And then they redesigned it and all of that stuff kind of went away. And it was just stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was just like I didn't feel happy going on Tumblr at that time. So that's why I felt like at the time it was just the best decision for well-being to just shut everything down with my Tumblr stuff and just kind of just focus more on my Twitter and Instagram.
So,
pages, because I feel like that's where it's been happening more.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I confess I still don't understand Instagram. One day, hopefully I will.
Yeah.
So you connect with Rick, and Rick becomes one of your most frequent collaborators in comics. Mm-hmm. Why? He's been on the podcast before, and hopefully most of the people listening may have already heard of him. But describe what it's like working with him, and describe his writing for us.
It's interesting. I try to figure out how to word it, because I would say working with him initially, the only way we did communications was either through just text message, like just essentially direct messaging each other through Tumblr or Twitter or emails. And that was throughout everything when we were working on Earworm, Ghost Butterfly, Earworm, and Chameleons. And then last year, when the big pandemic thing happened, we decided to actually, because with the starting of Merryweather, we just decided to try and do weekly meetings to just discuss about what we're thinking, and just feel like that helped both of us to try and generate ideas and like discuss what we need to focus on projects and all of that. So I felt like that has helped me especially focus more on how to get the work done and all of that. And then you're saying that about his writing?
Yeah, his writing and your art have a kind of a shared vibe that I think goes together very well.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe Rick's writing to someone?
I feel like with Rick, what he does well is that he looks at an artist and gets the idea of how to get his story to work with the artist. And that's how, yes, I felt when doing it with, especially I think with Earworm, when you pitched that one towards me, of how it was done. We just kind of like worked together on, like, I try to work with his script ideas, and then he tries to also maybe make tweaks to the story to work with some of the concepts I was proposing. Because I think one that really sort of like where we kind of almost like worked together. He did more of the script than was, especially with Chameleons. Because with Chameleons, the idea was, it's actually based on two concepts that I proposed to Rick when we were trying to generate story ideas, mm-hmm. which one was, I think the concept was called Target Acquired, which was the idea that these people in a weapons research facility are hiding from a rogue automated weapon system, and they have to rely on like camouflage or cloaking tech to hide from the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other story concept I had when we were talking about it was, it was just called Gods, which came up with the abbreviate. I think it is an abbreviation, which is Geo Orbital Defense Satellites. And the idea that this is like tribal post-apocalyptic world where these tribes are waging war, but one of the tribes have like spears that have attached targeting beacons. So when they throw the spears, these weapon satellites just fire at target the spears and then fire upon them. So it's these two little little concepts got merged together to become Chameleons, which is one of the stories featured in this anthology we've done.
Yeah, so let's go into depth a little bit more on the anthology itself. You've teased Chameleons here and its genesis. Tell us at a high level what the campaign is, what backers will get, and then we'll move on to like specifics and the stories and stuff.
Okay, so at the moment with the Kickstarter page, one of the main rewards is the book itself, either digital PDF version or physical copy, printed copy containing the two stories, Earworm Chameleons, as well as two new stories by two different artists that have joined us on this project. First one story called Tell Us How You Really Feel. Sorry about that. That one's being drawn by I'm just trying to remember the name. Nami Oshiro, who's doing that one. And from what we've seen so far with the artwork, that looks really good. And then the other story we're going to have featured in this is Computer Blue, which is about an android where you can upload all your negative thoughts and emotions into this android. And that is also being drawn by one of the other artists who've joined in is Amy Wilensky. And then we're also going to have some pinup artwork featuring some guest artists of some personal favorite indie artists that we've met throughout our time on social medias and also just having chats with them, and just some all this other cool stuff. I think there's mugs and some, I think, chance to buy some of the original art, some original artwork theming on this anthology as well.
And you have clearly done some preparation just for the promotional aspect of the campaign. There's some really attractive animated GIFs that you have to help promote. Tell us a little bit about those. Those are really interesting.
So I think when we decided to doing the designs and visuals for the anthology collection itself, I think one of my inspirations for doing it was I wanted it to be like this corporate research institute feel to it. So I think one of the definite big inspirations that I think some people will definitely pick up is the research institute from the video game series Portal, the Aperture Science. Me and Rick like this idea that we are this, the Uncanny Valley is this research institute that specializes in narrative research simulations. So this anthology is essentially showing these stories are like simulations that this research institute is doing.
Yeah, they're very attractive and very cool looking. And as one of the perks at one of the reward tier levels. Backers, if I'm not mistaken, they can get a not an animated GIF, but they can get a similar employee portrait, correct?
Yeah, they can get a temporary employee ID image sketched, drawn by me to as like one of the higher tier backers and all of that. So I just thought it'd be kind of fun to have, because we just like I said, I just like the idea of these. I think the idea of the ID employee ID portraits is, I think, probably one of the more obvious ones is the codec portraits from Metal Gear Solid. And I think, but just like, I just like the idea of these employee IDs, and I just thought it'd be a nice little touch to the world building design of the anthology itself.
Yeah, yeah, it's very, very, very attractive. That's for sure. So, let me see here. So you told us a little bit about Chameleons, which is one of the stories that's included. Another one of the stories is Earworm. And I need to give a disclaimer before we talk about this. I'm actually credited as a co-writer on this one. So I have a little bit of a vested interest in the success of this whole project as well, but my contribution is very, very tiny in the overall scheme of this project. Tell me a little bit about how Earworm came about on your radar from Rick.
With Earworm, I think it was because when Rick proposed the anthology back in the end of 2017, I think it was right before New Year. He sent me just like a pitch list of like all the initial short stories, and I think Earworm was actually the first one on the list of the ideas. So so it was that, because he was describing this idea of a noir thriller of just like these mysterious murders, and the only thing that's connected to it is this unusual sound. And I just thought, oh, that could be, that's interesting, and just thought, yeah, let's do this. I definitely wanted to get back into in comics, and I felt this was the best way of doing it.
Excellent. Yeah, that one turned out really well. That's a, both Chameleons and Earworm are truly, truly fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just saying that I was surprised that with Earworm that it got shortlisted for best comic of 2019 for Pipe Dream Comics. I think I didn't even realize it was being shortlisted for it at the time. I think it was Pipe Dream Comics.
Hey, that's fantastic. I didn't even know this. That's cool.
Yeah, so I think it was because I think it was like someone on Instagram like going like, "Hey, congratulations on your shortlisting." And I'll go, "Wait, what?" And I think I actually did mention this to I think in one of my previous podcast interviews about it. So it was just kind of funny that that we got shortlisted for Earworm to be one of the best comics for, yeah, I think it was 2019 for that. And but yeah, that was quite a nice surprise for that.
So you have mentioned that that this is an anthology series and that there are other contributors, Nani and Amy being among them, and there are a number of others as well that we have not discussed. But in general, the overall approach here, this is volume one, and in the future there will, at least it's planned to be, additional volumes, right?
Yeah, we're hoping to still, well, Rick is currently still working on doing some new short stories for future stories for the anthology. So we're hoping to kind of continue with this and hopefully get some new artists to join into the project as well, to share more of the stories and concepts of this anthology.
Cool. So let's talk about the future for yourself outside of Uncanny Valley. You did mention earlier that you changed your work approach with Rick on a project called Merryweather.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that one.
Okay. Project Merryweather, It's the one I'm currently working on development and working on pages slowly. We started this project last year when the pandemic started, because after, I think the original idea, what originally happened is we finished Chameleons just at the start of 2020. And then everything happened with the pandemic. And then at the time we were planning to actually, I was going to do another Uncanny Valley short, which I think it was called The Receptionist, which was about a future where there was incurable diseases and the only way to help people were to transfer their minds into synthetic bodies. And when we were looking at this and seeing how everything was going with the pandemic, we just went, I don't think we're in the right mindset to do this.
Yeah.
So it just felt like this is too depressing for what's going on outside. So Rick messaged me saying he's had this new project idea called Merryweather, which really interested me because it was sort of, it was inspirations of like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation, I think Nier Automata, the video game Death Stranding, just essentially a really interesting set of post-apocalyptic narratives that I've liked myself personally. And we wanted to kind of do like more, I think the right term is positive sci-fi instead of dystopian sadness all the time. So it was just interesting to do this project and some of my own personal work, like my own personal drawings and concepts, like fitted really well with this concept. So we just wanted to actually develop this, hopefully this new project series for this. And it's just at the moment, I'm taking my time to make sure I'm getting it to look good. But hopefully now I should be in the right mindset to do page production now.
Yeah, I'm afraid I've made this joke several times, but I can't resist it. When I first learned about Project Merryweather, I was initially very skeptical and worried because when you say pivoting away from sadness and dystopia, to me the Quinn Lorbecki brand is sadness and dystopia. Yeah. So I felt like we were maybe going to have like a Bob Dylan Goes Electric scenario here. Mm-hmm. But then over time, as the work began developing, I've been privileged to see some of the previews of the ideas and the concept artwork. And it's perfectly correct for you guys. It's like you're not skipping a beat at all. It seems like a perfectly natural evolution in your storytelling, your narrative, your art. It's working really good so far.
Yeah, and I think as well with Project Merryweather, as I've been developing it for the visual designs of it, around the time Netflix had a really fun animated series which had similar ideas called Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts, where it's an old age animated series, but it's set like 200 years in the future after civilization's been decimated by these mutant animals. And this teenager's like, who lived in this underground burrow, has been trapped on the surface and tries to find her way back home. And just the art design and the characters and all of that, it just felt like, yeah, we can make fun post-apocalyptic stories without it being miserable and depressing and horribly bleak.
But you do it so well.
Yeah, I know we do it so well, but I feel like at the same time, I think because of the bleak, depressing post-apocalyptic, I feel like I'm one of those people now where it's like, it's done so many times now.
And
I think I've discovered like some like post-apocalyptic narratives that like definitely done different ways of telling the story, like tell a different way in the same setting. And I just found those kind of ways of doing it is really interesting for what it is. And it's just kind of nice to do post-apocalyptic, but not follow the same formats that usually go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. It is an interesting. I do like post-apocalyptic sci-fi and cyberpunk genres, but I always like the idea of having twists to those genres and not always follow the norm with that. So I think it's like the same with like Neon Genesis Evangelion. In its own way, it is a post-apocalyptic series, but there is still civilization and humanity is still trying their best to save mankind. And the finale is such a surreal thing. And I just like those surreal and not typical post-apocalyptic settings.
So let's talk a little bit about your process and your style. One of the signature elements of your style is you not only illustrate your comics, but you also almost always, as far as I know, color them yourself as well. And you frequently, if not exclusively, use watercoloring. And I'm curious, on the one hand, let's talk about what led you to that style and then talk a little bit about what it's like to utilize that style in a given project.
Sure. Well,
how did you arrive at that style?
The watercolor style. That was interesting because I think before the watercolor style, during like my university days, I think I did a lot of like water-based inks and like digital kind of like coloring. So like minimal color palettes and all of that. And I think before meeting Rick Quinn, that I even went, I think almost like a Ben Temple Smith coloring phase as well.
Okay.
So I'd like did everything in like black and white shading tones and then like just add like a color tone on top just to bring it out more. But those coloring processes, that it just felt like, I think I was just taking too much time doing it, and I just felt like there's got to be a way that I can keep consistent.
Now, then, when you talk about adding a coloring tone on top of the sort of gray wash, would that be done also in watercolor, or would that be done digitally?
No, this was all done digitally. So it was
okay.
So the black and white shading was all done in Photoshop, and then I added a color on top. I think, as I mentioned, I think very briefly I did like a 2-page anthology submission for a zine. I think it was back in 2016, so I kind of sort of forgot about that whole thing. That I think I spent like 3 or 4 weeks on those 2 pages on its own, because I colored it in one way, and then I felt like that didn't work, so I had to redo everything again, and I think I was calling it close to the submission. So I just felt like I like the style, but I can't keep it consistent or a reasonable time length. And then around this time, I was starting to read Jeff Lemire's work, Sweet Tooth and Trillium, for watercolors, and as well as Matt Kint's Mind Management and Department H, or Depth. I don't know how people want to pronounce that title of that comic.
Well, as an American, I could just sit here and listen to someone from the UK pronounce the letter H all day long. Say that again for me.
H. Don't worry. People here because of my American accent here in the UK, I think there was one person who kept asking me to say marshmallow, because I say it very different to them here, so it's very funny. But yeah, so I think it was funny with the mindset of starting to do watercolors, because I think during university I didn't want it to do watercolors because I felt like it was an expensive material to purchase, and I don't think I can figure it out. I'm just seeing all this stuff and I'm like seeing all these impressive watercolor illustrations that I think some of the other students were doing, and I'm just like, I can't get my head around it. I can't figure this out. I don't want to waste money and then realize I'll never use this material. And then I think I found like a nice, I think after reading like Jeff Lemire's and Matt Kint's comics, like ones drawn by themselves as well, I just felt like with the styles, I'm like, yeah, I think I can get that to work with the stuff I do. And I think I found like a nice little watercolor set that was on sale in a nice little art shop in London and started practicing with watercolors. So, and I think that was actually in 2017, months prior to Rick finding my work for Butterfly. So that was the first comic using the style that would be become now. And I think one of a major inspiration for the watercolor art style that I do now is Studio Ghibli concept sketches, watercolor sketches that are done by Miyazaki himself. And I think I really liked, I think one of my most favorite Studio Ghibli art books was the Nausicaa art book, as like the, essentially the first half of the book is all of his watercolor illustrations, and I just loved what he did with them. But yeah. I think I also liked the little concept sketches where it was only just like two or three colors used to bring like almost like an like bring environments to the draw, to the sketches that he's to the, that they did. Mm-hmm. So those were kind of like the Jeff Lemire, Matt Kent, and Studio Ghibli watercolor sketches. They were sort of the core inspirations to the watercolor style that I've been developing for the last few years.
Yeah. And so as you approach projects now, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about just your overall art process. How do you iterate from the script to the final page? I've witnessed some of this, so I'm aware of a little bit of it. You do start with a pretty quick pencil thumbnail, right?
Sometimes I do pencil thumbnails, but then I think, especially when working with some of these scripts, I spend a bit of time to try to do like world building drawings, so I can just get the feel of like the characters, the settings, and all of that, and then as well just develop the techniques that I was going to use to make the final thing. And then when I think I have all the world elements for the script, then I do the thumbnail sketches. And then once I feel like I've got both the character designs, the environment designs, the thumbnail sketches, and everything together, then I just start making the pages. But sometimes what I do like to do sometimes is do page tests. So essentially I make a complete comic page, not based on the script, but just purely just to test out the style and the theme of the comic, to make sure that I'm happy with the way it's going to look when I start making these pages.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of examples of those from you, and I love that, and I wish more artists would do that. And a few times I've actually started a project and write a quick little premise page just for that same purpose. But I would almost rather the artist come up with an idea for what to be on the test page. I think that works really well for you.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a really good way to just get the mindset of going like, this is how I'm going to get these pages to look. And sometimes I think especially with chameleons, I did do a test page, but then I kind of converted it as a teaser, saying that this is the next Uncanny Valley story, and this is how it's going to look. So it's not like a really high quality, like highly rendered illustration that's not going to be like the comic pages itself. I just kind of like the idea that you're going to see what the comic is going to look like itself.
Yeah, it's almost equivalent in my thinking to what they do in movies and television, and they call a sizzle reel, mm-hmm. which, you know, is often comprised of test footage or inspiration from other projects, you know, kind of cut together in a new context with new music or whatever, just to give you the aesthetic sort of mission statement of the, like the tone of the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yes, I think it is kind of nice to do those, especially I think last year when we were developing still developing Merryweather, I did the pages for a prologue page, which just to experiment the style that I was going to go with for that project when we get that going. So we did that. I don't know yet what the plans are releasing it at the moment. I'm still having an internal conversation with myself of, I want to redraw the prologue because I think I've done designs much better. And Rick is going like, no, you're fine, it's good. I'm like, no, I want it better. So, and I think it's one of my problems with me when I do world building. It's like, I don't know when I can say, yeah, that's good enough, or go like, I think especially with Merryweather, it's like, I feel like I got all these other ideas. I think I can tweak the designs like this, and I don't think it's ready yet. So sometimes that's been a problem, but hopefully now I can definitely focus on working on those pages now.
Yeah. As a third party observer, I think this is a project, an example where you may have gone too far in that part of the process. I've been seeing some of these concepts, and I've always been annoyingly teasing you with like, hey, I want to see pages. Apologies for that, but also not apologizing for that. I think there are some projects that would actually that you would maybe be able to get away with including a lot of that world building in the book itself. Mm-hmm. And not just as extras. There are certain projects that I think would benefit from having those sorts of things as almost like, meta commentary or alternative perspective type things.
Yeah.
The fact that you have that as a key part of your process, I think overall definitely helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I think one of the nice things with Merryweather is we're just treating it as episodic chapters with each comic. So it's not like, oh, we got to do this X amount of pages. We do a story set in this world and we just keep doing it like that, just kind of small chunks. And I think that's kind of, I feel like for me and Rick, one of our strong points is just doing these short narrative pieces.
Yeah.
But I feel like it is definitely interesting us doing this kind of like almost like ongoing long running project series idea. So I'm looking forward to this because this is something very different to what I've done before.
In many ways.
Yeah.
So. Well, it's off to a great start. I'm privileged to have seen mm-hmm. Some of the stuff. But my only feedback remains the same feedback. More, faster, more, faster, yeah. More, please. Well,
hopefully when we get the Uncanny Valley Kickstarter going, I could definitely focus more on that.
Yes, everybody listening, please back the Uncanny Valley at double whatever level you can afford. And we can get that into the world and the next thing as well.
Yeah.
Trust me, it's going to be fantastic. So one of the things that we like to do here on the program is put all of our guests on the spot and ask them, what's on your cultural radar? What are you reading? What are you watching that you can recommend to us?
Okay. I think one of the big ones for me that's definitely under my radar is not a comic, not a book or a film. It's actually a video game that I've been playing since last week Friday that I've been excited for since the start of the pandemic because it was announced was the remake of the original 2000 game post-apocalyptic RPG called Nier, but it's one of the versions of Nier called Nier Replicant, but they have the other title for this is Nier Replicant version. This is the reboot version 1.22474487139 ellipses, which, as I was saying before about, I've been really interested in like alternative post-apocalyptic narratives or like surreal ones. This one with Nier, it's one of those ones that have been one of my big inspirations in recent years because of the world that these games are set in are so surreal because it's like set thousands of years in the future. And but it's annoying because I don't want to spoil it, because if you ever do play it for yourself, Nier Replicant specifically is really different and unique, and it's not what you think it is.
Interesting. Now, am I remembering correctly? Have you also recommended in the past the soundtrack for this series?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things for this game, Nier, is its soundtracks. It is quite arguably one of the best soundtracks I've heard of all time, like for scores and all of it. Especially for the original Nier, because it just had these really unique mixes of songs. I think my personal favorites is the first track called Snow and Summer. And I think there's some other really good ones. Song of the Ancients, Fate, Emile, Sacrifice. But there's just so many good songs in it, and they've done so many different album like soundtracks. I think there's like piano covers, remix albums, but one of the recent ones they did was the orchestral arrangements, which I was lucky enough to actually see one of the live concerts in London. And I think when I saw that perform live, I nearly cried because it was so beautifully performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra. I think that's the orchestra for it. But it's the soundtracks for Nier are all of the soundtracks for the Nier franchise are definitely worth listening to, and I've enjoyed listening to a lot during my when working on these comics as well.
Now, this all sounds incredibly intriguing and fascinating, but it also sounds to me like it could potentially be one of those franchises that might be intimidating to start, like, you know, like Gundam or Star Wars or whatever, or Doctor Who, just in terms of, like, where do you start? Like, where would you recommend someone start to get into the Nier universe?
I would definitely recommend the new one, Nier Replicant, because it's the remake of the original Nier that came out back in 2010, which I think only because it was a weird thing because in Japan they had two different versions of the game, and so there were two versions called Nier Replicant and Nier Gestalt in Japan. Replicant, which is the one that didn't get released in the West at the time, is because that version was like a brother and sister story. But the one we got, which was called the Gestalt version, it was a father and daughter story. So the protagonist of that game was two different people, like two different ages of character, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit weird, but So in 2010, we only got one version of Nier. And then this year, they decided to remake the game, but they wanted to use the Replicant version, so it's the brother and sister story.
Okay.
So the actual story of the game itself is still the same. It's just the type of protagonist is different.
Interesting.
But it's still one of those things. I would like to say as much as I can about it, but I feel like the less you know about the story of this game and the way the game works, the more you'll enjoy it when you discover it for yourself.
Cool. Well, that does sound fascinating, and I have threatened to do this many, many, many times in the past decade, and I've kind of halfway done it and failed, but I'm gonna try to get back into video games this year, and on my calendar is the remaster or redo or whatever they're calling it of Mass Effect. I've never played
the remaster,
and that has been very very acclaimed and highly recommended by a number of people. So I'm gonna try that, and I'll try Nier here as well.
Yeah, I would say Nier Replicant, the remake of Nier, is definitely worth playing, and also it's definitely worth playing the sequel, Nier Automata, where it's set, I think it's like 8,000 years after the events of the original game. And there's cool. This whole machine war between machine life forms that have been made by an invading alien force and the android resistant groups built by humans. So you play the androids fighting these machine life forms in this super far distant post-apocalyptic future.
Cool.
But
well, this sounds. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying they're really interesting games, and especially how they do their stories and how they work with the game mechanics as well.
This sounds very, very intriguing. I definitely want to check it out.
Well,
so
Go
ahead.
No, I was just going to say about the other things under my radar as well. I didn't know if that's what you were going to ask me.
Yeah. Is there anything that's outside of the realm of video games, since I'm so lax on video games at the moment?
No, that's fine. I got some others. I think other one, I just recently finished the Netflix limited anime series called Yasuke.
Oh, wow, that was fast. That just came out, didn't it?
Yeah, it just came out, I think, Thursday, 29th of April. That one's a 6-episode series, and I enjoyed it. It's it had a really good team. The series was directed by LaShawn Thomas. Sorry about that. He directed an anime series, I think in 2019 that I enjoyed as well, called Cannon Busters. But also the music's done by a really good composer that I've really enjoyed recently is Flying Lotus. He's also done some music for, I think, some anime projects. I think he did Carol and Tuesday and the Blade Runner short film, Blackout 2022.
Okay.
So he's really good. And Lakeith Stanfield voices the main character, Yasuke, as well. So
I'm sold. That's all you needed to say. I'm sold.
So it's a really interesting, I think it's a fantasy sci-fi retelling based on a 16th century samurai warrior, the first black samurai. So it's really interesting. I think it did inspire the creation of the anime Afro Samurai as well. But yeah, I've just finished watching that recently, and I really enjoyed that series. That's definitely worth watching. It's only 6 episodes as well, so it's quite nice.
Excellent.
And I'm trying to think. Other things, I've recently just finished audiobook for an interesting sci-fi horror called The Fold by Peter Kleins, part of it's called the Threshold series. Because that one's about this guy investigating this DARPA research team that claim they've successfully developed teleportation technology by folding dimension fields.
Mm-hmm.
But as they're saying, it's perfectly safe, it's all fine. There's just this horrible suspicion that there's something else might be going on with that. And it's just the way the story has been, it was written and told, it's very well done, and the mystery, like, it's definitely worth reading for that one, for if you like Lovecraftian themed sci-fi horror.
That sounds very interesting.
And try to think other things that have been that under my recent radar is the album Nurture by Porter Robinson, an electronic album. That one's really not. I really enjoyed all the electronic music in that, and that's actually been one of my recent album music inspirations for Merryweather.
Very cool.
And then I think lastly, film-wise, just so we can tick that off the list, is Palm Springs. I think it's on Hulu for the US, but over here it's on Amazon Prime. It's a time loop movie that I was surprised how good it was.
Yeah, I heard a lot of very positive reviews, and I just anticipated it being some sort of rom-com or something.
It's got the
based
bit
on
of
the
rom-
participants.
Yeah, it's rom-com, but I feel like it's, in a way, it's sort of like a modern day Groundhog Day, like how Groundhog Day would be done now. But okay. It's, I think Adam Sandberg does really good as the guy who's been stuck in the time loop for a questionable length of time, and he's just gotten so used to it.
We will take that last statement under highly skeptical advisement. I don't know how many of our listeners are aware of this, but I'm a co-chair lieutenant in the local chapter of the Andy Sandberg Hate Society. So I will reluctantly give this film a whirl since you have praised it so highly.
Yeah, it's.
Please note that I go in with advanced baggage.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, I think the nice thing about this film, I felt like this film is really well paced. It didn't drag out and all of that. So, and all the actors in it are really good. I think J.K. Simmons is really good in it. I don't want to spoil what his character is in that film, but yeah, that it's a fun to watch time loop film. For that.
Fantastic.
And I don't think there's anything else. The only comic thing I guess I'm reading is just my Kickstarter copy arrived for Maddie Once Upon a Time in the Future, the Duncan Jones and Alex D. Campy graphic novel, but I'm only halfway reading it, so I can't really can't say much about that yet.
Yeah, that's on my list too. I haven't had a chance to read that. That looks fantastic.
But so mainly for me is just near games that have been on my mind under this cultural radar. I think if we did this a few months ago, I'd probably be talking about that post-apocalyptic anime decadence.
Oh yes, at one point we'll need to table a separate discussion for that.
We need to have talks about decadence.
Yeah, I bailed after the second episode on that. It's an anime that makes a very bold narrative storytelling choice. And I normally applaud boldness, but in this case, it caused me to eject. But you've tried to convince me to stick with it, and I at some point I may give it a try since you've been such a ardent supporter of it.
Yeah, we'll probably make, I guess we'll have to make a special podcast episode just talking about decadence.
All okay. Right, cool. Well, let's schedule that and do that. Thank you so much for all of your radar recommendations. And before I let you go, please tell everyone where they can find you on the internet, on social media, etc.
Okay. You can currently find me on Twitter and Instagram under the tag for both places is Merton, spelled as M for Mother, Free, R for Roger, T for Tango, Y for Yankee, N for November. And also have a website that's MertonIllustrations.com, but that usually the website's linked with my Instagram and Twitter page.
Excellent. And like I said before, his Twitter feed is very cool in general. He posts art and but also recommendations like the ones we just heard.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, best of luck on the campaign.
Thank you.
I'm hoping for total success. And I'll once again, even though I have a very small involvement in it, everything that I'm not involved with is fantastic. And I just highly, highly recommend it to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Martin.
No, thank you for having me. I'll hope to speak again sometime.
All right, man. We'll do that.
Take care. All right. Bye.